You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos provides HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. They put HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. Learn more about Kronos HR, payroll, talent, and time at kronos.com/HR Swagger. That's kronos.com/HR Swagger. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. For several years, Andrew Morantz, a staff writer for The New Yorker, has been embedded in two worlds. The first is the world of social media entrepreneurs, who, acting out of naivete and reckless ambition, upended all traditional means of receiving and transmitting information. The second is the world of the people he calls the gatecrashers, the conspiracists, white supremacists, and nihilist trolls who have become experts at using social media to advance their corrosive agenda. Now, in his new book, Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation, Andrew reveals how the boundaries between technology, media, and politics have been erased, resulting in a deeply broken informational landscape, the landscape in which we all now live. The book ranges broadly from the first mass-printed books to the trending hashtags of the present, from the secret gatherings of neo-fascists to the White House press briefing room, and traces how the unthinkable becomes thinkable, and then how it becomes reality. Today, Andrew Morantz joins me on the podcast to talk about how he ended up embedding with the so-called deplorables and getting a rare insider's glimpse into the pundits, trolls, and provocateurs who drive the conversation on the alt-right and even influence our mainstream political discourse. He recalls his strange relationship with a right-wing media influencer who is able to manipulate America's political conversation, spread conspiracy theories, and even put words into the mouth of President Donald Trump. He also discusses how Silicon Valley's laissez-faire libertarianism opened the door to hate mongers and conspiracy theorists, how social media algorithms actually promote that type of content, and why he says it's time for tech leaders to stop hiding behind the First Amendment. Plus, he gets into how one of the worst offenders, Reddit, is now cracking down on hate speech, the bizarre story of the neo-Nazi who's married to a Jewish woman, and the pitiful demise of obnoxious right-wing gadfly Milo Yiannopoulos. Coming up with The New Yorker's Andrew Morantz in just a moment. Andrew Morantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he's worked since 2011. His work has also appeared in Harper's, New York, Mother Jones, The New York Times, and many other publications. A contributor to Radiolab and The New Yorker Radio Hour, he has spoken at TED and has been interviewed on CNN, MSNBC, NPR, and many other outlets. Andrew has written extensively for The New Yorker about the alt-right movement and how social media enables and even encourages political hate. Now he's giving a big picture look at this issue in his new book titled Antisocial: online extremists, techno-utopians, and the hijacking of the American conversation. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, you are a Brooklynite, and you write for The New Yorker, so I'm just guessing that the alt-right probably is not really your scene. Mm. I'm curious, how did you first get drawn into this whole world?
I'm not writing a firsthand memoir of how I came to love and cherish the alt-right. And, you know, when I showed up in a lot of these spaces, I think that was pretty clear. Like, one of the first big scenes in the book is this inauguration party called the Deplorable, which is how they spent their inauguration weekend. You know, I think most people remember Hillary Clinton sort of saying a lot of Trump supporters could be put in a basket of deplorables, and that word immediately got reclaimed as like, yeah, we're deplorable, we're proud of it, we're going to have a deplorable. And so when I showed up there, it was not that mysterious what I was doing there. Well, it wasn't. Like, on one hand, I think people got, okay, you write for The New Yorker, I even had one guy who was like very sort of forcefully like, what's your deal, man? And kind of wasn't taking vague answers and was like, I just want to know like who you are, where you're coming from. And I basically said to him, like, take a look at me. Take a look at my glasses. I have a single speed bike.
Yeah.
Like, just take a guess and you're probably fine. And in a way, that was sort of true. In another way, that was a kind of cheeky dodge, right? Because, you know, as much as our sort of political landscape would have you believe that you can sort people by all kinds of superficial identities, that's true and it's not true. So it's not that I went in there to try to be completely supportive and sympathetic for all of, you know, to all of the alt-right's views. I think most of their views are reprehensible, and I say so very plainly in the book. It's just that I felt that it was possible to be accurate, be specific about who was this kind of white supremacist, who was this kind of Nazi, who was this kind of troll, who was this kind of nihilist who didn't really have that many beliefs, but who was causing manifest damage to our democracy nonetheless. And to go beyond that and not just do a kind of taxonomy of badness on the internet, which, you know, is part of the book, but is a very, you know, I really try to go beyond that pretty early on in the book and do a broader tapestry. But that was possible to do while balancing, on the one hand, you know, sort of factual, objective truth-telling, while on the other hand, not forfeiting my right to have eyes and ears and a brain and a heart and a soul and say, when bad shit is happening, I'm going to call it for what it is.
Yeah, and it sounds like, I guess, the fascination kind of cut both ways, because as much as some of these alt-right media trolls profess their deep hate for the quote-unquote mainstream media and decry outlets like yours, The New Yorker, they're almost shameless in the way that they court you and other media outlets. In fact, there's a scene in here where I think you were at one of their parties and they're just all swarming you, vying for your attention, saying, talk to me, talk to me.
Yeah.
Did you confront them about this hypocrisy?
Yes. It's hypocritical, but there are so many hypocrisies to sort through that it's like, who has time for them all? Yeah. I mean, it was hypocritical. It was also just kind of thirsty, as the kids say. I mean, it was very out in the open. And on the one hand, yeah, I can call them out for hypocrisy, and I did sometimes. On the other hand, it's like it made me sort of second guess whether I was always like it made me second guess whether I should always be writing a particular story or whether I should leave it alone, because, you know, you don't want the interaction to be too transactional. There's always something transactional about journalism ever since, you know, Janet Malcolm has made a big deal about this. Joan Didion has pointed this out. I mean, it would be naive to think otherwise, but you don't want to be too, you know, sometimes a lot of these sort of trolls would approach you as if like, we're all in on this. We're all kind of doing the showbiz thing. You're going to do your thing. I'm going to do my thing. And I was like, I kind of wanted no part of that. Again, I didn't want to be unfair. I didn't want to call them names that were just made up. But I did want to say, like, you and I are not two sides of the same coin, buddy, you know?
Yeah.
And in some sense, you can't avoid that. Like, in some sense, to give any of these people attention is to give them that much of a win. Like, insofar as you are giving them attention, you are giving them something they want. So I can't write that out of the equation. All I can do is make a more complex equation that goes, okay, attention is one thing, contextualization is another thing. And ultimately, like, a lot of things did not meet the threshold of me wanting to write about them. But sometimes I went, okay, these people are out here. They're doing what they're doing. They have massive influence, massive appeal. Even sometimes when they don't, sometimes they just have huge audiences, like people I write about in the book, Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, whatever. They are public intellectual, not intellectual. They are public influential figures.
Yeah.
Other times they might be less sort of visible publicly, but still have a huge influence in a way that's more unseen. And so largely when things did meet that threshold, it was because my thinking on it was, we can turn away from it. We can ignore it. We can pretend it's not happening. We can, you know, not feed the trolls, quote unquote, but it doesn't make the influence go away. And in fact, to take that one step further, these people are putting out their playbook and it's kind of on us to read it. Like, yeah, they are proudly telling us what they're doing. And by shielding ourselves from it because it's unpleasant and because it's unseemly and because we don't want to give attention to the trolls, we are handicapping ourselves. And by us, I mean like all people of goodwill who don't want bigots and trolls to take over the national conversation.
Yeah.
We are handicapping ourselves by not reading their playbook, which is out in the open to read.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, with all the attention on Russia's social media influence on the 2016 election, do you think that we've almost done ourselves a disfavor in allowing that to overshadow all of this homegrown trolling that's been going on in the background?
I do. I mean, it's not to say that we should discount the foreign actors and the states, the state spying and all that stuff, not only from Russia, but from Iran and China and all these other places. But I do think that by focusing so obsessively on that, some people allow themselves to shield themselves from the more unpleasant fact that a lot of their co-American citizens are openly doing some of this stuff, not anonymously, not on by, you know, being ordered to do so by any, you know, dictator, but just because they think it's fun, or they think it's politically advantageous, or they want to profit from it. And I think in a way that's like harder for people to face. But the other thing is, not only do I think on any measurable scale the American side of it is bigger and more influential than the Russian stuff, at least the stuff we've uncovered so far, I also think it's like you can drive yourself crazy, and I've seen friends do it, going, well, maybe this dot connects to this dot, and it's like, maybe it does, man. I'm not going to, you know, there are conspiracies in the world, so there, yeah, and they are worth theorizing about sometimes. But the very nature of it is that it seems pretty clear from the evidence we have so far that what the GRU and the IRA and all these Russian entities want is for Americans to be confused and gaslit and muddled and thrown around. Why not start with the stuff where people are telling you what they're doing? They're out in the open. You don't need subpoena power. You don't need Robert Mueller to go find the info for you.
Yeah, like, good point.
I sat in these rooms and watched them do this stuff. They were not anonymous. They were not shy about it. Like, start with that, because that we know is happening, and there's no need to feel spun around and gaslit. You could just see it for what it is.
And I want to talk about one of these people who is a little bit less public about what they do and kind of operates in the background, but has this enormous influence. Mike Cernovich, tell us a little about him.
Yeah, so he was one of these people who was totally open with me, totally fine with me coming into his living room and just sort of being a fly on the wall and watching. So, you know, he was one of the organizers of the Deplora Ball, and there were a lot of people at this party who were tugging at my sleeve and saying, hey, I'm interesting, come talk to me. And you know, with any of these people, as I said, it's a calculus. You're trading off various factors. With someone like Cernovich, so he is a lawyer who came to prominence during the Gamergate movement, which there was a version of this early draft of this book where I did like a huge digression about Gamergate, and then I just ended up cutting it all for various reasons. Book was too long, and it took too much time to get into what Gamergate was. But basically, it was this misogynist movement that kind of showed how a swarm of online bigots and trolls and bad actors could affect real world change, get people fired, get ads taken down, get people harassed and swatted and fear for their lives. Cernovich was a big part of that. He was the Gamergate lawyer, he was called, because he was a guy who had a law degree, but through various twists in his life, which I document in the book, he was unable to practice law because he had a rape charge that was hanging over him. And
wow.
Yeah. So he had a very, very, a lot of these people's lives, and, you know, it's dozens of people in the book, They're the kind of details where it would sound made up if it weren't for the fact that it was documented. I mean, the fact that the internet's leading misogynist, his life was derailed by a rape charge.
Yeah.
The fact that his first marriage, which fell apart, he, in the divorce, inherited a bunch of Facebook stock, which then, after the IPO, made him a millionaire, and that funded his trolling campaigns.
Wow.
These are the kind of things that, if you put them in a novel, your editor would be like, it's a little much, you know? But the reason that I did, again, with all these trade-offs, like, even though I found him kind of odious and pathetic in many ways, and, you know, he was constantly, like, sort of like, well, bro, like, you need to stand a certain way because it really, like, helps your cortisol levels and, like, all this sort of junk science stuff.
Yeah, and he's hawking supplements and stuff on
skin products.
Website.
And, yeah, I mean, it's all, like, it's all laughable except for the fact that, A, it makes him a lot of money because, you know, snake oil salesmen have always done pretty well in this country. And, B, not only is he doing all that stuff to make himself a buck, but he is having a manifest, measurable election influence on the 2016 election. So when I first reached out to him, it was pre-election, and I was just sort of like, you know, it wasn't only about Trump and would he win, although I did make a lot of bets with friends that he was going to win, but I had just this larger sense of like, if we can get so turned around, if our informational ecosystem can be so warped and perverted that we are, that there are just active influence campaigns to try to make it seem plausible that this clown should be president, and they're working, then there's something wrong with the informational ecosystem at a systemic level. And so I wanted to use people like Cernovich and watch specifically and carefully what they do, not only because I thought it might have impacts on this election or the next election, and not only because people could then learn the tricks and try to inoculate themselves and look out for the tricks when they see them. All of that is there, but it's also at a larger level, like, how have we built a system where this stuff is happening at such a large scale?
Yeah, and you spent some time at his home watching him sitting at his computer doing his thing.
Yeah.
Walk us through how Mike Cernovich makes a meme and takes it all the way into the mainstream political discussion.
Yeah.
How does it work its way in there?
Yeah, and I did think it was important to track specifically how it happens. I offer a couple of examples, but it was literally multiple times a day, again and again. So, like, for instance, you know, you walk into his house, and it's not just him, I should say. He's particularly good at it, but there's lots of other people who are echoing these strategies all around the country and all around the world. So, you know, like one of the days I was there, and again, at the time, I was kind of naively like, wow, this is a big day for him. But it was just kind of like anyone who sets up a laptop and anyone who has put in the time to learn this skill can do it. It's sort of like the flip side of people being like, you know, you can just like open GarageBand and make a song. It's kind of like that, but like with destroying democracy. Mm-hmm. So he would say, like, the first day I think I was there, there were a couple of bombs that went off in New York City, and nobody knew what it was yet, but it seemed like it might be terrorism. And he was sort of thinking, okay, if this is like an immigrant from a Muslim majority country, then that would be really good for me propagandistically, because one of his goals was to shut down immigration and to sort of pin that on Hillary, to try to paint Hillary as the open borders candidate. And so now you see what you get with open borders. You get bombings. Now, none of that really, like, logically played out. It turned out that the guy who planted those bombs was an American citizen. There were, like, a whole bunch of problems empirically with that, but that doesn't matter so much when you're doing sort of insinuation campaigns on the internet. So he opened an iPad. I was just, you know, he had this little sort of kitchen table thing, and his wife, his second wife, was sort of puttering around and making us coffee. And, you know, it was just sort of this nice cozy, like, they had she was pregnant at the time. They had a dog outside. It was just sort of, it was not the 14-year-old troll in the parents' basement kind of thing.
A relatively normal existence.
Yeah, and he would sort of say, like, yeah, I just, you know, destroyed Hillary in this news cycle, and now I'm going to, like, go for a hike with my dog. And, like, he was very into that kind of dichotomy. Mm-hmm. So he set up the iPad on the table, started a Periscope video, which is, like, this live streaming app that's owned by Twitter. And they would, his hardcore fans would gather. So it wouldn't be a million people, it would be 1,000 people, but they were, like, the hardcore Cernovich fans who, anytime he sends a tweet out, they would follow him wherever. Mm-hmm. They go into this video sort of chat, and he's talking at them, which is his preferred mode. kind of like mansplaining politics. Huh. And they are all typing in the comments. So some of them are just typing like, you're a cuck, whatever. And then others are typing suggestions on what should our hashtag be. If we want to inject this insinuation into the news cycle that somehow a bombing in New York should be associated with why you shouldn't vote for Hillary, how are we going to do it? And so it wasn't enough for them to just sort of, in some loose, unaffiliated way, just sort of insinuate this. They had to do it in a coordinated way. So they start throwing around hashtags, you know, Hillary's terrorists. Hillary is a terrorist. Hillary bombs, like, and they were like, ah, that's not really quite, it's not catchy. It's not really believable. Like, nobody really thinks Hillary is a terrorist. So then I think that one, and literally they would do this multiple times a day, but wow. I think that one they settled on Hillary's migrants. And so they would sort of say, okay, Hillary's bringing in the migrants. Make sure you spell it without an apostrophe, because if you have an apostrophe, it'll mess up the hashtag. Huh. Sort of coordinating this, all of which, none of this is against the rules of Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like, they were just sort of like, this is how we do it. We get 1,000 people. We all agree on the same hashtag. We all go to Twitter at the same time and start posting. And you post things, ideally things that have images in them that are really visceral. Because one of the things to understand, and I kind of broaden out this whole conceptual framework in the book, is that the algorithms that underlie Twitter and Facebook and all these things are built around emotional engagement. They're not a flat mirror that tells us what people in the world are thinking. They are warped in all these various ways. And one of the ways is that they show they privilege what scientists call high arousal emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, gee, I think I have some concerns about foreign policy. That's not a high arousal emotion. High arousal emotions.
Sexy.
It's not sexy. So lust is one, literal arousal. But then there's also, you know, fear, disgust.
Mm-hmm.
There are positive ones too. Awe, mm-hmm. humor. But, you know, the reason the book is called Antisocial is that for a long time, we only thought about the pro-social. Like, I think of it as, like, antisocial is stuff that tears down a civic fabric and pro-social builds mm-hmm. it up. And, you know, we thought for a long time about cat videos and humor and, like, yeah, maybe it's a little bit kind of negligible, but at least it's, like, bringing us together. It was making the world more open and connected. And we just totally discounted the ways that antisocial emotions are way easier to cultivate in your audience. If you want to make people inspired, it's actually pretty hard. If you want to make people fearful and disgusted, you can do it literally in seconds.
Right. That appeals to our lizard brain.
Exactly. And so if you want, and if you hit the lizard brain in the right way quickly enough, I mean, because speed also matters, then you can get something trending. Mm. So in this particular wow. case, they said, okay, you know, put out photos of Hillary kind of looking mean and like she's going to, you know, be the open borders person and she's going to hurt us with that policy. They all go to Twitter. They all do that. They get it trending. And then once it's trending on Twitter, this is another thing people don't understand. That it seems when you go on Twitter, there's this list of trending topics. And it seems like that's just sort of an objective map of
what
people are talking about. But in fact, it's a proprietary algorithm where Twitter is showing you things. It's personalized. Two people might see two different lists of trending topics. And so, but to journalists who are, Twitter is like for journalists basically, when journalists see the list of trending topics, they see it and go, oh, that's a thing now. Now this is something I need to write about because it's in this sort of official looking mm-hmm. list of topics. So then, you know, you have journalists writing about some people out there are saying that Hillary is the open borders candidate. And so then it gets into the bloodstream.
Yeah.
Then it's on the Drudge Report. From the Drudge Report, it can go to Fox News. From Fox News, then CNN has permission mm-hmm. to talk about it. Then the newspapers have permission to talk about it. Like basically to the point that I could go open my newspaper the next day and go,
wow,
Cernovich has his fingerprints on this story.
I mean, are there cases where perhaps even specific words and phrases went from Cernovich's computer, maybe not directly, but eventually to President Trump's mouth?
Definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, so another one would be sick Hillary or Hillary coughing mm-hmm. or I mean, there was, again, this perception and you know, Cernovich, just as an example of someone who was a lawyer, was well-read, you know, he would tell me, like, I have lots of specific things I could say about her policy toward the Saudis and, you know, and actually another one of these weird details, even though he's often perceived as a white nationalist, his wife is of Iranian descent and her parents are Muslim. And so there's all these sort of individual life wrinkles. I mean, there are other there are sort of pretty much out and proud neo-Nazis in the book who I write about who have were married to Jewish women and have black adopted siblings. And it just, it's just a weird world. Like, it's one of these things that I would not have known if I had done the making it up as I go along thing. Mm-hmm. I would never have been able to predict this stuff.
Yeah, you talk to one person who's particularly loathsome among all the deplorables named Mike Enoch. He's the founder of something called the Right Stuff blog and the host of the Daily Show Up podcast, mm-hmm. which is a play on the Daily Show for, I guess, neo-Nazis or something. Mm-hmm. This guy is a Nazi who, I don't know if he talks about exterminating Jews, but he talks about certainly getting them out of this country. And yet he was married or is married to a Jewish woman.
Yeah.
How did he and his wife rationalize that?
I mean, rationalize is the right word, right? I mean, it's just people are just extremely weird and messed up. Like, people are, I just, you know, and again, like, it's very easy for people to hear this stuff and think, well, yeah, there have always been a few Nazis around and they've mm-hmm. always been kind of freaks and weirdos and, you know, what does that have to do with me? But, like, I just found over and over again, the more of these stories I dug into and the more resonances I found with the larger world out there, this is not unique. Like, the extremity of it might be way more than we normally see in our daily lives. And, you know, we don't all have, you know, friends who become full Nazis. But the means by which somebody can do things that make no sense or that seem contradictory on their face, that stuff is happening all the time. And we kind of tell ourselves this story that, you know, people have their beliefs, they have their politics. You know, after all, these people voted for a black president. How could they be racist? You know, all this stuff that, like, it just doesn't hold up under scrutiny. So that's why I really tunneled into some of these stories. Like, that particular guy, he grew up in a part of New Jersey that was this very kind of, you know, pastoral, kind of like suburban multicultural landscape. His parents were both professionals, you know, both academics, actually. His father taught Beowulf, and his mother was a college president. And they just, he was, I mean, many, many things were going on, and that I get into a lot more detail. But basically, he was, like, addicted to contrarianism.
That's really interesting, because I think that for someone like you, who does not really fit in with this crowd, that was in a weird way sort of your window to relate to these people because you talk about when you were a kind of the angst-ridden teen who was always cynical and contrarian, and that was kind of the way you related to them. Huh?
Absolutely, yeah. And so it wasn't like relating to them fully, like, oh, I totally get you and I'm like comfortable with what you do, but it was a way in to sort of see, like, because again, it's very easy to caricature this stuff and distance ourselves from it and go, what in God's name does that have to do with me? And I think we ignore that at our peril. And so one of my ways in was to say, okay, I don't think I ever would have been a full Nazi. Like, being Jewish kind of makes that inconvenient. But, like, if I had been, you know, I think we all go through these kind of, like, angsty teen rebellion phases. Mm-hmm. I certainly did. And I had all these phases where I was like, well, I don't know what I am, but I'm not what all you motherfuckers around me are. Like, I'm not your sort of normie Abercrombie wearing, like, I'm my own thing. And I didn't know what my thing was. I just knew it was in opposition to that. And I feel like if I had been in that delicate space of, you know, being an eighth or ninth grader going through that, and I had a computer in my pocket that could give me whatever answers I wanted to any questions I wanted and could shock me and titillate me and make me feel like I had special secret knowledge that was known only to me and my secret cohort of enlightened people, and everyone around me was benighted and stupid, I think some version of that might have been really appealing to me. I don't know if it would have been the full Nazi version, and I think maybe I would have been able to find my way out of it eventually, but I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, and you talk to other people who are maybe not full-on Nazis, but what they refer to as the alt-light, and among those are people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who is or was sort of this provocateur and alt-right gadfly who for a while became something of a celebrity. And I wonder, do you think that he and people like Mike Enoch really believe anything, or is it just all about getting a reaction and growing their brand, as they say?
Yeah, I think Milo believes nothing. I think people like Enoch are actually hardcore ideologues.
Oh, you do?
So I think there's a whole spectrum where I would actually put them on opposite poles of that spectrum.
Okay.
I think Milo is, I mean, he he patterns himself after Mariah Carey. That's what he told me anyway. He wants to be famous. He wants to be fabulous. He wants to wear designer clothing. I mean, one of the things I found in looking back through, and again, these people are all examples and archetypes. And I want to always remind people that, like, even though individual people might fall off the radar, like Milo, for example, his career is effectively over. He has mm-hmm. nowhere else to turn. He's been banned from every platform. He's become a national punchline, rightly so. I mean, he is a punchline of a person. But that doesn't mean that the next person can't come along and be a little bit more savvy. I mean, it's similar to the Trump thing. It's like Trump will eventually go away, but mm-hmm. there might be a newer, savvier version that would actually be more effective and just be a little bit less flamboyant right. about it. So I think it's similar with someone like Milo. We sometimes like are a little too premature to dance on the grave of these individuals rather than thinking more systemically. So, but yeah, when I went back and looked at his stuff, you know, the one thing he seemed consistent about was free speech absolutism, free speech for everyone. I can say whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And then you go back like 2 years into his record of deleted blog posts, and he's writing about how online trolls need to be regulated because they're so dangerous. And wow. So, yeah, so there's very, very little consistency there. But with people like on the more, you know, the alt-right ideologues, the propagandists, the people who are doing what they call white nationalism 2.0, mm-hmm. trying to take, you know, the old David Duke style thing and put a more web savvy sort of meme-y face on it. I think those people are often converts to an ideology that is, mm-hmm. it's almost like a religion with them. Like they yeah. are super hardcore about huh. it.
And one thing that you talk about in here is how people like Mike Enoch and others have this routine of they throw something hateful or anti-Semitic out there, and then they sort of retreat and say, oh, it was just a joke, lighten up, everything's too PC these days.
Yeah.
And yet, as you point out in the book, the things that they say get inserted into the discourse and gradually begin to push the boundaries of what's acceptable in our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to me, that's why, you know, so the subtitles, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. And we're, you know, the online extremist part is pretty easy. The techno-utopian stuff, you know, we can get to about how the kind of founding myths of these companies allowed this stuff to flourish. But the American conversation thing, it gets thrown around as a kind of cliche, and it is. But, like, there is nothing foreordained about what the American discourse is going to be. It has, for the majority of American history, been extremely terrible in many ways. I mean, the founding documents of this country were built to protect slavery. And, you know, a document is nothing but a record of a conversation. Like, it's just words. So I think we have had this tacit myth for a long time that the arc of history bends toward justice and, you know, ultimately in the long run, progress will be made, as if it were this kind of automatic thing, when actually things can be pushed in a positive or a negative direction. Mm-hmm. And what we decide to do as a polity is a product of what we believe and how we talk to each other. I mean, I really on a deep level believe that. So it's not just like, oh, the chatter of, you know, the sort of chattering classes. Like, yes, there's a lot of parts to the conversation, and some of those parts can be dismissed in various ways. But what we decide to do socially, politically, civically, whatever, is a product of these kinds of conversations. And when you talk about the Overton window, this is this concept that, you know, is borrowed from like a public policy think tank, but I think, you know, has broader implications. Policy can only happen if it is conceivable. And the Overton window is this metaphor to describe, you know, things inside the window are things that are thinkable, and they might be, if they're toward the edges, they might be, you know, fringy or controversial. If they're in the center, they might be so obvious that you don't even have to debate them. And if they're outside the window, they're unthinkable, unsayable. And the project of the alt-right and to some extent the alt-light is to push the boundaries of the Overton window, or just to sort of break the sashes of it altogether to the point that their ideology can become sayable. So it might still be controversial. It might not be implementable. They might not be, you know, all sort of swarming into Congress 2 years from now. But they see themselves as kind of visionaries in a sense, and in a terrifying sense. They see themselves as broadening the conversation to allow for things like, well, why should we be a multi-ethnic democracy? Why can't we be an ethnostate? And the answer to that is not, well, we can't possibly be because it's written in the Constitution. Actually, the Constitution says we should be a white ethnostate, and we've just been trying to move beyond that for the entirety of American history. So, I mean, I don't want to freak people out too much, but, like, we're kind of, you know, we don't have as much of a safety net with this stuff as we like to think.
Yeah.
We have norms, we have conventions, we have traditions, but norms can be rewritten.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about this other aspect of the book, which is you get into how social media companies have mostly inadvertently facilitated alt-right provocateurs, and you get into the techno-utopian philosophy that has guided many of the social media entrepreneurs. Tell us a little about that.
So what I mean by techno-utopianism is this notion that's kind of related to this kind of myth about the arc of history always bending toward justice. Mm-hmm. It's this notion that, you know, we're going to make the world more open and connected, as the Facebook motto went. We're going to move fast and break things, as the other Facebook motto went. Kind of almost whatever we do, as long as we're connecting people and kind of unleashing more freedom onto the world, there might be bumps in the road, but ultimately it's going to land us in a better place. And that is like, that's a myth like any other myth. There's no real reason to believe it. You're not on some tracks that are just leading you inexorably in the right direction. It's like a wide open field, and, you know, you could run off a cliff. Like, bad things could happen. And when you have this faith in techno-utopianism, you know, from when these companies were founded in 2004-ish, 2005-ish, until more than a decade later, there was really very, very little pushback. I mean, there was really this decade of kind of this golden halo around these guys that, you know, we put them on magazine covers. We say they're the great innovators. And of course they're innovative. And of course their thing, you know, the products they build have positive ramifications.
Right. The Arab Spring.
Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter. There are these social movements that grow out of these things that would have been impossible otherwise, or if not impossible, they would have been hampered otherwise. But it's just folly to think that any great innovation in human history can have only pro-social effects and no antisocial effects. It's just not how it works. And with any other big industry, we're very quick to say, like, you know, it's really nice that we're able to use these swords to, you know, beat the British in the Revolutionary War. But, like, is there any way that swords could become dangerous? Like, there's no we're very good at, like, seeing both sides of the coin. It's really nice that doctors can prescribe pills to help people with their pain. But, like, is there something bad that could happen with that? We're not this naive in other areas of our lives. And yet you see so much pushback when you say to people, opening up and freeing and democratizing speech and toppling all the old informational systems could have negative effects. They're like, oh, well, you just hate free speech. Like, no, it's really, really not that. It's just like we got to think about it in a more complex, multifactorial way.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, a lot of these tech leaders or big swinging brains, as you call them in the book, they spend tons of time and energy tackling other big problems that probably don't even exist yet, like hostile AI and ending death.
Yep.
But they're so flippant and fatalistic about this one problem that's largely within their control.
Exactly, yeah. And I have a couple of scenes in there of some of these big swinging brains, as I say. It's sort of a play on the Michael Lewis thing of big swinging dicks. And, you know, that's what he calls these bankers. I call them big swinging brains because I think they're not only about, you know, accruing money and wealth and power, although they love that stuff, but they want to be luminaries, and they want to have, you know, they want people to turn to them and say, what do you think about, you know, whether we should colonize meteors? What do you think about whether we should, you know, whether, you know, death is a curable disease? What do you think, you know? And they invest huge amounts of time and energy and money into solving those, in many cases, literally unsolvable problems. And yet when you say, hey, you guys moved fast and broke things, and one of the things you broke is media, and not only media like, hey, it's hard for the Huffington Post to make a living, but like media like everything about how we know and see and understand and appreciate the world around us. You guys broke that. Could you try to fix that? They're like, oh, it's an impossible problem. There's nothing to be done. People just want what they want, and, you know, the market's always right. And I just find it so bizarre and hypocritical and just implausible on its face. And yet, because we had 10 years of this sort of halo effect, you still hear people making these arguments on the left and the right, all kinds of people making these kind of weird apologia arguments for these companies. Mm-hmm. Well, what would you have them do? Like, come on. These are people who are telling us they can fix climate change. They can fix the education system. They can't fix media? Like, we yeah. And I think it's and I also I'm kind of trivializing it, but like, if we don't fix the media problem, we can't fix any of those other problems. Mm-hmm. If we don't fix the national conversation, to go back to the subtitle, if we don't fix the way we talk and think and operate in the world, because make no mistake, what you see online affects how you think, how you operate, how you behave, how you vote. If we don't fix that, we can't do the difficult stuff of fixing the climate, fixing, you know, denuclearizing, figuring out new energy sources. Like, that stuff requires a common set of facts, a common set of like emotional valences. It requires a functional marketplace of ideas,
yeah,
which is the thing they broke.
And one of the biggest breeding grounds for the most vile content, hate speech, conspiracy theories, all kinds of offensive stuff, has been Reddit. And for the longest time, it was this space where anything goes. You spent some time with the co-founder and CEO, Steve Huffman. At this point, does he express any regrets about Reddit's role in facilitating that kind of stuff?
Yeah, he does. And one of the reasons I spent so much time with him and embedding in the offices of Reddit is that he is one of the few people in this world who is willing to change his mind about stuff and mm-hmm. speak about that openly. There are a few reasons that I found Reddit interesting. One is it's just massively influential. It's you know, by the numbers, it's bigger than Twitter. It's bigger than Netflix. It's just terms of web traffic, it's this.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. I'm not someone who spends a lot of time in subreddit chat
rooms.
Yeah,
well, it's just a huge, I mean, a lot of us aren't. I wasn't, but mm-hmm. I was just like, yeah, by the numbers, this thing is just huge. And it's also, it plays a key role in the kind of meme ecosystem. Like mm-hmm. a lot of things mm-hmm. bubble up from there that then sort of take over everywhere else. And yeah, it's like, and I mean, another practical reason was that they just were willing to give me access as a journalist in a way that very few companies are. I mean, if you go to Snapchat or Twitter or Facebook and say, hey, I just want to hang around and see whatever I see and just write about it, they're like, how about you go take a long walk yeah. offshore up here?
And you tried and were rejected by pretty much every major
yeah.
social media platform.
Yeah, I had to try. And this was, remember, back in the day when they were giving nothing. Now they'll give you a little tour and they'll mm-hmm. bring you to a meeting and whatever. But back then it was nothing. So because I think now all this stuff has broken out into the open. I mean, back then it was like, it wasn't entirely a secret, but I was sniffing around stuff that they were still hoping to keep entirely in the closet. But yeah, Reddit was just like, yeah, you can kind of just hang around. And that's the kind of reporting I really mm-hmm. like to do. I really like to just be a fly on the wall and see things as they happen. So that's what I was doing with the online extremists, and that's what I was doing with the techno-utopians. And when I did it with the Reddit people, they were, yeah... So it was started by these two guys, Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian. Huffman came back after 10 years. He started it in 2005. He left. And the analogy I make is to just a big warehouse party. You know, you kind of start this big party. You open up the doors. You don't card anyone. You kind of just say, here you go. Like, freedom, no rules. Mm-hmm. Do whatever you want. And then you leave for 10 years. And then you come back and there's a few hundred million people at your party and they're
right.
doing this insanely horrific stuff. And
yeah,
you're like,
the cops are raiding the
yeah,
party.
Well, no, the cops aren't the raiding the place. Yeah. That's the problem. Yeah. So then, yeah, it's just people just lighting stuff on fire. And you're like, how did this happen exactly? So, yeah, he does express regret about that. He doesn't sort of say like, you know, we should just shut down the internet. But he says, yeah, I was naive. I was a kind of like cocky young techno-libertarian. I just sort of thought that the marketplace of ideas would work itself out. I just thought that, like, you know, the way Reddit works, it's very simple mechanics, is upvoting and downvoting. And I basically thought if I gave people an up arrow and a down arrow and there were enough people there, they would the wisdom of the crowd would sort of help all the cream rise to the top. You notice when you start talking about this stuff, it all becomes cliches, right? Because we're talking about our beliefs rather than, like, actual evidence.
Right.
So he just sort of believed, like, oh, the good stuff will rise to the top because people will upvote it. Sometimes that happened. Sometimes it didn't. And then when he came back in 2015, he said, okay, new sheriff in town. Actually, old sheriff back in town with a new ideology. I'm a little more grown up now. I'm in my 30s instead of in my 20s. I still love, you know, freedom of information, and I still love people expressing themselves on the internet, but some things are out of bounds. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't, you know, Reddit is still a pretty raw place. It's a place where people swear a lot and have a lot of really snarky memes, and there's even pornography on some parts of Reddit. It's not like a kind of sanitized, homogenized feel like Facebook. Mm-hmm. But he did sort of say, if you have a subreddit called Fat People Hate that is devoted to hating fat people, and you keep, you know, showing again and again that you are only interested in promoting hate and fear, and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you're doxing people, maybe you're doing all these unacceptable things, I'll give you a few warnings. And then if you keep violating the rules, I'm shutting your thing down.
Interesting. What is their policy? What kind of things do they deem now unacceptable that might get banned?
Well, the policies keep evolving. So, mm-hmm. like, for instance, in 2017, pre-Charlottesville, so, you know, there was obviously this big march in Charlottesville, Virginia, with a bunch of white supremacists holding tiki torches. Steve Huffman and Alexis Ohanian just happened to be alumni of the University of Virginia, which is the campus where that protest happened.
Huh.
So in addition to just being American citizens who were offended by this, as everyone was, they were triply offended because not only were they alumni of the University of Virginia, they were also the founders of this platform where a lot of these people were organizing to make this rally as big as it was. So they were like, okay, so to your question about how the policies are written, previous to Charlottesville, they had a policy against violent content, and it was pretty narrowly tailored. It was like no content that incites violence. I forget the exact word. I think it was no content that incites or encourages violence. And then after Charlottesville, they said, well, A, we need to be much more vigilant about things that were already in violation of that policy that we just weren't cracking down on. So right from Huffman is on a plane on his Wi-Fi seeing these images of, you know, news articles about the tiki torches, and he is chatting with his employees saying, if these people are anywhere on Reddit, I want them gone.
Huh.
His quote was, really? Nuke them.
Wow.
And they said, Steve, you seem a little emotional. Let's talk about this on Monday. This was like on a Saturday. And then he came in on Monday and said, yeah, I was a little emotional, but frankly, like, I think it's better to have an emotional response to Nazis marching than to not have an emotional response to that. But also, you know, yeah, nuke them isn't really policy. Like, how are we going to make this a policy?
Yeah.
So they did a couple things. They shut down some of the groups that were already in violation of their violent content policy, where they were just openly celebrating the fact that a protester had died at Charlottesville. And that there were a few, there was a subreddit where the top post was, it's really great that this woman died. And they were like, okay, you're gone. And that subreddit, actually, I get into it in the book, that was a subreddit called Physical Removal, and it was based on this whole philosophy. I mean, I even hesitate to use the word philosophy, but it was basically, there was this German philosopher who was such a hardcore libertarian anarcho-capitalist that his philosophy was, if there's anyone within your community who is violating your social order, then you need to physically remove them.
Huh.
So essentially justifying homicide in the name of his libertarian.
Wow. Terrible.
And so this was in the early days of Reddit, this would have been like, well, you're just talking about philosophy. Now that it was like, yeah, no, you don't get to talk about that shit here. And it was, I think it was hard for people like Huffman because he still has that techno-libertarian ethos in his bones somewhere. So I think there was a part of him that said, is there going to be a slippery slope here? If we can't talk about violence, then what if we want to talk about the Bible? The Bible has violence in it. But then the other part of him went like, no, 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 we're going to shut this down. And like, yeah. I don't suggest anywhere in the book that any of this stuff is easy, that there are sort of 100% right answers that anybody can find. I certainly can't. But that doesn't mean that you are paralyzed with fear and you don't do anything. So so they got rid of that, and then they sort of had a few weeks where they were trying to rewrite their violence policy to say not only stuff that outright incites or encourages violence is banned, but also we're going to ban things that glorify violence, things that they added some verbs to the policy.
Huh.
And then they let me watch that process and talk to everybody who was involved with it, but they also said, you should be here on this set of days. And so I went to San Francisco to be there. And they said, okay, today is the day we're going to actually get rid of all this stuff. So they all got in a room and opened their laptops.
Wow.
And sat down and got a bunch of free snacks. These companies love free snacks. And said, okay, this subreddit called Kill the Jews. That one's gone. This subreddit called Kill the Jews, J-O-O-S, that one's also gone.
Huh.
This one, well, actually, that one has swastikas, but they're in more of like a historical context. That one can probably stay up.
Okay.
And so it was this very like human, messy approach, like bunch of people, you know, 28-year-olds sitting in a room deciding. And like, it's really weird and uncomfortable to be in that room. It's like, oh, you guys are just deciding who gets to speak and who doesn't. But it's also like, I'm not sure that we have a better alternative right now. Mm-hmm. I think we can think long term about how to build better alternatives. But right now, these people are gatekeepers, whether they like it or not. And so they just have to be good at being gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. And now that sites like Reddit and Facebook and Twitter are finally beginning to act on these things, you have people like Milo Yiannopoulos and Alex Jones and many others who have been banned from most social media. I think Laura Loomer even got banned from Uber and Lyft for saying something offensive.
Yeah.
And you say that the deplorable's assumption up to now has been that there would always be some new social media platform for them whenever they got banned from the mainstream ones like Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Has that been the case, or are they starting to run out of places to go?
It's a good question. So they'll never entirely run out. So I think people like Milo and Loomer and those people who have just, I mean, Laura Loomer has made this part of her branding. She calls herself the most banned woman in the world or something. And, you know, she wears that as a badge of honor to her fans. Now, it's kind of like a Zeno's paradox thing. Like you can get her to not be able to radicalize the mass public by getting her off the mass public platforms.
Mm-hmm.
But she's still on, I think she's still on Telegram. Nobody ever gets kicked off Telegram. Nobody ever gets kicked off Gab. There are certain...
I've never even heard of these ones.
But this is the thing that like the trade-off is these are smaller networks, but they brand themselves as hardcore free speech absolutist networks.
So it's still that thing of they may only get 1,000 views, but then it gets disseminated eventually.
They're going to be the hardcore of the hardcore. And because these platforms are so devoted to free speech, they can really push the boundaries. So you can be on Telegram and essentially threatening violence. I mean, there are lists that people pass through Telegram of, you know, here are a bunch of Jewish journalists and we're going to try to find out where they live. And
oh, my God.
Yeah. So and Telegram, you know, it is not an American company. It's registered in Russia. And so they just say free speech. So the trade-off is it's smaller. The community is smaller, but it gets more and more radical and more hardcore in its, you know, it sort of hunkers down and festers. I mean, Gab is where the shooter, the guy who shot up the synagogue in Pittsburgh, he was on Gab.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, 8chan is down right now, but when 8chan comes back, it's going to be one of these places. So, you know, the problem is never entirely gone. And I do think on the whole, I mean, it's case by case, but I think generally on the whole, when something truly shouldn't be on a platform like Reddit or Twitter or Facebook, and when it's clearly violating those rules, when it does get removed, I think on the whole, it is a net benefit because A, it's violating the rules, and B, it does shrink the audience. I mean, people like Alex Jones just are making a lot less money now.
And yet I wonder, because, you know, just today, I guess I saw that Laura Ingraham on Fox News last night was starting to talk about, of all things, George Kent's huge water bottle, you know, after the first impeachment hearing. And it was just so weird and off topic that it made me wonder if that might have begun as a Cernovich meme or something from another one of these alt-right characters. Have you seen any evidence that some of these same alt-right media trolls are trying to drive the conversation on impeachment now?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, they're always trying to spin things. The word narrative, I haven't gone back and counted, but I think the word narrative must be one of the words that appears most frequently in the book because they're constantly talking about narratives. How are we going to own the narrative? How are we going to spin our narrative? Sometimes it's an innocent thing, like the George Kent water bottle thing. I actually saw that on many, many parts of Twitter. I saw lots of lefty Twitter. Yeah, it was just a like, what's the deal with the water bottle? It's weird that Laura Ingraham's picking up on it, but I mean, it could have just as easily been, you know, Rachel Maddow picking up on it. I think when you see other things like Laura Ingraham talking about, you know, rootless cosmopolitan elites or globalists or whatever, you know, some of the alt-right people see that and go, oh, she's talking about Jews. And
oh, really?
That's, yeah, okay. Those are all code for Jews. Now, I don't know that that's what she is intending. I have no way of proving that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's also, again, because we just live in a weird, terrible timeline. You know, Stephen Miller likes talking about rootless cosmopolitan elites, mm-hmm. and Stephen Miller is Jewish, but he also likes nodding to the JQ.
Right. They play to their audience.
They play to their audience, yeah. And so when I would ask some of these neo-Nazis, why is Laura Ingraham talking about cosmopolitans and globalists on Fox News, they would say, oh, that's a nod to the JQ. And the JQ means the Jewish question.
Wow.
So that's how they see it. And when, you know, if you go, as I recommend you don't do, to visit, you know, Nazi propaganda sites like the Daily Stormer, they think that Tucker Carlson is the most important person on their side. They think Tucker Carlson is their biggest hero.
I had a weird thing. A few years ago, I had, of all people, Vicente Fox on the show.
Oh, cool.
And he was doing his whole F. Trump thing and all that about the wall.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. And they picked up on a picture of him and me. And somehow it got disseminated on, on Daily Stormer. And they started talking about, oh, this Ben Mathis, he's a Jew. I'm not Jewish, but like, I'm just wondering, like, where in the world are they coming up with this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting mix of sometimes they know that they're putting out disinformation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're just confused. Yeah. Huh. I mean, the Jew thing is such a weird, I did not expect for this book to be about antisemitism. I went into this thinking, as a white guy, my contribution to this can be that I can kind of infiltrate these spaces and they'll let me in because I'm a white dude, cis, heterosexual, male, white guy. When I got there, in some circles that was true. In the more alt-light circles that was true. And when I was like going into the White House briefing room with some of these trolls, and when I was going to, you know, dinner parties that they were having in D.C. And then in those circles it was true. Huh. And when I was, you know, talking to Breitbart people, and like, but then when you get out into the Nazi territory, they don't think I'm white. They are very, very committed to this notion that Jews are not white. Jews are these devious shapeshifters who can seem to be white.
Wow.
And that they can claim whiteness when it suits them, and they can claim victimhood, non-white status when it suits them.
Wow. So they cling to some very, very old school stereotypes.
Yeah.
I mean, like 19th, 17th century stuff.
Yeah, like Protocols of the Elders of Zion stuff. And I was sort of like, really? Like, you guys got to update your code here. Like, this is super quaint, laughable stuff. And yet, it is kind of core to their cosmology in ways that I lay out, like, in ways that I had to piece together. Mm-hmm. It does kind of help them explain things that they couldn't otherwise explain. Like, there are a lot of these things where you go, okay, everything in this worldview is wrong, but it still has an internal coherence. And they have things that they feel that they need to explain to themselves. And a lot of these bad ideas are like very efficient Occam's razor ways of explaining otherwise inexplicable things. And the Jews help them with a lot of those things. Now, we don't have to get into all of it, but basically when they were chanting in Charlottesville, they were chanting two things: you will not replace us, meaning like non-whites, and Jews will not replace us.
Oh.
And when I saw that, they were going back and forth. You will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. And I was kind of like, you think you're being replaced by Jews? Like, there just aren't that many Jews in the country. Like, why are you think your jobs are being taken by us?
Yeah.
And then I was like, no, that's not at all what they mean. They mean that there is a concerted effort. It's really Protocols of the Elders of Zion. There is a concerted effort that the Jews are masterminding to create a multi-ethnic coalition that they can then rule to drive down white majority strength and power, and then allow non-whites with Jews at the center of it to rise. It's a much longer thing, and I get into it. But basically, I was surprised at the amount that mattered to them, and I was surprised at how bad they were at piecing together. To your point about like who is or isn't Jewish, like if the whole contribution that you're offering to your audience is that you can help them figure out where the Jews are and what they're doing and how they're operating, and their big obsession is naming the Jew. If that's your like value add that you're offering to people, why are you so bad at it? I had one guy actually, Mike Enoch, when I first reached him, I was going to his family. I talked to his dad, who had disowned him. I talked to his mom, who they were divorced, and his mom had not disowned him. His mom was actually sending him new shirts because she knew he was going to be on TV in Charlottesville, and she wanted him to look good. And so these were the two kind of poles of how you react. And like, I was trying again, journalistically, I was trying to be like, I actually don't know how I would react if my son was a white supremacist. Like, would I never talk to him again? Or would I be like,
yeah,
make sure you text me and make sure you're safe? And I don't know.
Wow.
So I kept talking to both sides of this family. And I still to this day don't really know. And then as I was talking to both sides of the family, he caught wind of it and kind of called me on my cell phone.
Uh-huh.
And very sort of aggressively was like, I know what you're doing. We should talk.
That's kind of scary.
It was a little scary. And plus he records everything for his podcast. So I was like, okay, so I'm being recorded and he's asking me where I live. Like, it was meant to be a little bit menacing.
Wow.
And
that's
scary. When we eventually did meet up, this is flashing forward, but eventually we talked and I said, we should meet up in person. And he said, let's meet at this bar. And when I got there, it was a German beer hall.
Oh, wow.
And
it's spooky.
Yeah. So it's like, he's trying to get in your head.
Yeah.
You know? So, by that point I was just like, I just think you're kind of pathetic and let's sit at this German beer hall and drink beer. Like, it's fine. And he like wanted to talk to me about Israel. And I was like, no, I'm good. I'm going to have to debate Israel at my next Seder. I don't need to debate it with you. So but in that first phone call, when he kind of reached me and he said, I can't talk right now. I'm eating lunch and I don't like to lie, but I lied to him. He said, what are you eating? And the real answer was bagel and lox. And I did not want him to have that audio on his podcast. So I just said, I'm eating a salad. But then later we talked and, you know, to your point about they don't even know what they're dealing with. We talked for a long, long time, hours. And I'm going through, I had him on speakerphone. And my wife was in the other room and I kept doing this thing to draw people out. Apparently, I didn't realize at the time that I did this, but when people were talking, as a journalist, you want to get them to keep talking. We're in the same room, so you're like nodding and making eye contact. When you're on the phone, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept saying, right, 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 right. I didn't realize I was saying this. So he was like, this is why.
That sounds like agreement.
Yes. So he was like, this is why we need to drive all the half-breeds back to where they come from. And I was like, right, right, right. And my wife.
He couldn't see you rolling your eyes.
My wife was like, stop agreeing with the goddamn Nazi. So we're doing that. And then he's in the middle of explaining to me why there's this book I really need to read that's going to explain why the Jews are actually. And he wasn't always woke on the Jewish question, as he put it. He wasn't always red-pilled on the JQ. And obviously he wasn't because he married a Jewish woman, so he couldn't have been. But now he gets it. Now he knows. And this is the book that opened his eyes. And as he's recommending the book to me, he goes, wait, you're not a Jew, are you? I'm like, are you serious, dude? This is your job to know where the Jews are.
Yeah. And you had one job.
You had one job and like, Google me. Look at me. I'm not a secret. I'm not a crypto Jew. Yeah. I have a Jewish name. I have a Jewish face. I've written for Hebe magazine. I've written for Tablet magazine. Step up your game.
Wow.
But then, you know, then we kept talking for a lot. We've talked many times after that.
Wow. I mean, now that the light has started to be shined on people like him and kind of the alt-light social media figures, and some of the bad actors have been exposed and banned from platforms, Silicon Valley seems to be taking it a little bit more seriously. Are we in any better shape going into this next election?
I don't think so. Really? I think in some ways there are individual consumers who have gotten a little bit wiser, a little bit savvier. But then there are other consumers who haven't, or there are new consumers who, it's an arms race, right? Mm-hmm. So you have some people who go, oh, I know certain tricks when I see them. And I actually do think in some small way, part of what I'm hoping to contribute is to sort of tip people off to certain types of spin and misinformation and seeing kind of proto hate speech as it arises. So in that sense, like you can educate yourself. In another sense, it's very easy to throw up your hands and say, it just sounds like everything is manipulable.
Right.
And I'm just going to tune it all out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good solution either. Yeah. Or just say, well, I'm just going to log off and then everything's going to be okay. We still, like, at a broad systemic level, we have built a bad informational ecosystem for ourselves. It's not working at a fundamental level. So there are things at the margins that we can do that individually you can educate yourself and know things when you see it. You can also, you know, Facebook can implement new policies. It would really help if Facebook maybe didn't take down all political advertising, but tried to limit how much it can be micro-targeted and how much it can be manipulated. There are things that we can do, and some of that is being done, some of it's not. But the larger project of this book is a reductio ad absurdum is what I call it, like a showing how if we wanted a functional informational landscape, it's not the one we have.
Mm-hmm.
At a deep level, like what these algorithms are fundamentally incentivizing is just driving us in a lot of really warped directions. And that's not going to change before 2020.
Wow. Well, I found this book absolutely fascinating. And in a way, I think you really do a service here. Again, it's called Antisocial Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Andrew Morantz, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. This was great.
Thanks again to Andrew Morantz for coming on the podcast. His book, Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation, has been listed as a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and a New York Times Notable Book of 2019. Order Antisocial on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Read Andrew Morantz regularly in The New Yorker and follow him on Twitter at Andrew Morantz. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos provides HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. They put HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. Learn more about Kronos HR, payroll, talent, and time at kronos.com/HR Swagger. That's kronos.com/HR Swagger. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.